This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 6th of February 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. On today's programme...
I strongly support the initiative taken by Chancellor Merkel and President Hollande. The situation in Ukraine is critical and it's urgent, and therefore we all have to give as strong support as possible for the renewed initiative.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg there, but with the ink barely dry on a peace plan they carry, Angela Merkel and François Hollande rush to Moscow. The trouble is, will Vladimir Putin listen to what they have to say? We'll talk about that and some of today's other top stories with my special studio guests. Then we get the latest from our woman in Tunis.
There are no policies being addressed, there are no reforms being started. Nobody actually really felt responsible for anything. And that has not just been the case since October. It has been the case for quite a long time.
We'll also meet a man who's opted to take the road less travelled across the heart of the United States out of Highway 83. And...
this is the biggest interview since Frosty Nixon.
Frosty Nixon?
I mean, in 10 years, Ron Howard's going to make a movie out of this. We do this, we can interview any president on the planet.
We review the week's new films with Monocle's regular critic, Karen Krzanovich. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest world news.
Investigators say power was cut to both engines on the Transasia plane that crashed in Taiwan on Wednesday. Flight data shows the crew did manage to restart one of the engines. The plane suffered a lack of thrust before crashing into a river in Taipei, killing 35 people. The black boxes showed that the plane warned five times of stalling before the crash. The plane, which can fly on one engine, was carrying 58 passengers and crew. 15 people survived the accident. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the French President François Hollande have just arrived in Moscow this evening for talks with the Russian President Vladimir Putin on the Ukraine crisis. Their visit follows 5 hours of late-night talks with the Ukrainian leader Petro Poroshenko in Kiev on Thursday. They say progress is not guaranteed, but they will do all they can to end the bloodshed. NATO says Russia has provided vital military support to the rebels, while Judy Dempsey is a senior associate at Carnegie Europe in Germany. She believes Putin is reluctant to give in to Western demands, despite an opportunity to do so at the next crucial meeting between the United States and Russia in Munich.
He believes now that the West is out to really undermine him, if not initiate some kind of regime change, which is not the case. But at the moment, Russia has sort of bunkered down and is, you know, unbelievably anti-American. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see the kind of atmosphere here in Munich when Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, meets Joe Biden, the Vice President of the United States.
Meanwhile, the British Defence Secretary Michael Fallon announced that the UK will provide 1,000 troops to boost NATO's collective security. NATO Defence Ministers are meeting in Brussels and are expected to agree to more than double the size of NATO's existing rapid reaction force to 30,000 soldiers from 13,000. The Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis said on Friday that the country had no other choice but to seek agreement with its creditors and excluded the possibility of a bailout from future talks. The United States told Greece through its ambassador to work cooperatively with its European colleagues and the International Monetary Fund, and that Athens needed to push ahead with reforms. The Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott has vowed to defeat a challenge to his leadership. A vote will be held in Canberra on Tuesday and follows a drop in the Prime Minister's ratings in the last 6 months. Mr Abbott remained defiant, saying that he wished to avoid the previous government's instability.
The first point to make is that they are perfectly entitled to call for this. But the next point to make is that they are asking the party room to vote out the people that the electorate voted in September 2013. I want to make this very simple point. We are not the Labor Party. We are not the Labor Party, and we are not going to repeat the chaos and the instability of the Labor years.
And finally, Queen Elizabeth marked the anniversary of her accession to the throne privately, but nevertheless gun salutes in London and Edinburgh on Friday also marked the occasion. The Queen has been on the throne 63 years, and later this year, on the 9th of September, she will beat the record set by her great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, to become Britain's longest-serving monarch. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 18.06 here in London, 13.06 here in New York. Joining me now with today's news and their take on it. Here in the studio is Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard, and Alessio Patilano from the Department of War Studies at King's College London. The keener listener among you will notice that there is a sort of a theme of bellicosity running through the specialist subjects of my two studio guests today. And I think today's subjects actually reflect that. We'll be talking about Boko Haram and their new incursions out of Nigeria. We'll be talking a little bit about Islamic State. But first, let us head to Ukraine, where the crisis there has earned, it seems, a desperate sense of urgency. The French and German premiers are now en route to Moscow. They're trying to resolve the situation face-to-face with Vladimir Putin. Meanwhile, a tentative ceasefire has held in the town of Debaltseve. It's the heart of the current wave of fighting so that people can get out. So we have two military experts in the studio. Let me begin with you, Robert. This peace plan being taken to Moscow, drafted in Kiev earlier on today after a couple of days of negotiations being taken place there. The likes of Merkel and Hollande, will this peace plan and the people who bear it actually get anywhere with Vladimir Putin?
Gosh, it's amazing how they've set out with trying to damp down hopes and prospects. Mrs. Merkel's team said, "We're going to Moscow, but don't expect too much." And certainly you're getting the same from the French. And of course, the other, I suppose, supposed to be senior partner in Europe, though you wouldn't know it from his behaviour these days, Mr. Cameron, is totally absent, hasn't said a thing about this. It is very, very desperate days because, as you rightly have said, Emma, the fighting has picked up. Does it mark a new phase of the operation, possibly to hack out a big part of eastern Ukraine? From the battlefront, as you say, the conditions, particularly the civilians hiding in cellars and so on, seem absolutely desperate. So it's about as cold as the temperature there and here.
Alessio, Merkel and Hollande with this peace plan, we don't know exactly what is in it, but what do you think it might contain? This is pure speculation, so please do feel free to go to town. What do you think might be in it that could actually chime with Putin?
I think some measure of discussion about what is the minimum acceptable condition to draw a line under a ceasefire that would actually remain in place for longer than it takes you to say ceasefire. Because that has been the case for the last one that really didn't last too long. And so we have three different type of problems at the moment in eastern Ukraine. We've got the military problem. So we've got serious fighting ongoing. And I think what the Ukrainian authorities have been sort of saying for a very long time, yesterday, I think it was the foreign minister that ran his glasses and say, like, you know, it's crystal clear that Russia is fighting because you don't buy on a Donetsk market Russian tanks as a spare component to your grocery shopping. It seems to me, so the military dimension is pretty dark, it's pretty gloomy, it's pretty dramatic. So that has to be addressed. And so I would expect the proposal to address that component, where to draw the line, where we can sort of, even if uncomfortably, see it in terms of the two lines settling down on an imaginatory sort of line where they're happy not to fight each other, but just gauge at each other. The second dimension, of course, is the one concerning Vladimir Putin and his ambitions for the sort of the control of Eastern Ukraine. And of course, in that sense, I think there is very little that one can negotiate with because the ambition is quite clear. The third dimension, I think, is more problematic, is how to deal with Russia. So what it is that we take into the negotiating table? What is the bargaining chip? Now, Russian economy at the moment, because of the sanction, is in a very bad state. It's not really likely to recover. The question is, will this be enough? I'm not so sure, because otherwise we would have seen already some sort of change.
May I just pick you up on one thing that you said there. You said that the ambition of Putin with regards to Ukraine is clear. I mean, is it? He hasn't at any one point said, I intend to take Ukraine at all. In fact, he's gone in exactly the opposite direction, saying that Ukraine must self-determine despite the presence of these tanks. Do you get the impression, though, that he is hell-bent on controlling Ukraine through perhaps destabilising it permanently?
Well, I think you touched upon it. You said it yourself. I think the key issue is that being the champion of, by the way, I really don't have an opinion on this. I want the people of Ukraine to make their mind up. That is exactly the objective, because so long so they take a position that is aligned with the self-perceived image that Russia has in Putin's mind as the guardian of Eastern European balance, you know, everything else is fine and falls into place. So in that sense, I think. But mind you, this is a very difficult and very costly. We've learned it too well with 15 years of wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, that you can't just be the negative force. It's like, well, you know, I want them to sort themselves out, you know, to become independent and be happy with themselves. Yes, yes, and what else? If you don't have that sort of extra plan, at least that shows how to get from point A to point B, how can you actually make sure that that plan sort of becomes implemented eventually, one way or another?
Robert, just listening to what Alessio was saying, there seems obviously this momentum that a solution is being pursued. We have seen intense fighting take place in Ukraine before. This is not the first time that this has happened. But there seems to be, and I don't know whether it's just my personal perception, a diplomatic urgency, a feeling that, I think one commentator has said, that a diplomatic door is closing here. What are we looking at? And, you know, what will we be in 10 years' time when we look back at this? What will this episode be?
I want to pick up in answer to your question on something that Alessio said, which I think is very important. I think what is happening here, and Alessio really is an expert in this world, is it's a dialogue of the deaf. the perceptions of what is going on are so entirely different between the West, and particularly with NATO. I mean, I really can't believe that when you've got this sort of kind of institutional paranoia in Russia, which is genuine, it does exist, and they start talking about a rapid deployment force. Oh, it isn't going to be 5,000, it could be up to 30,000. You know, they've been discussing it again in NATO today, what they want. So here at full colon, I'm coming to the last paragraph in my reply to you. I think this is what has really spooked Merkel, and she certainly managed to recruit Hollande for this. She sees some all-out, dreadful all-out war on the eastern marches of Europe breaking out by mistake from this. And I think that is, what is the X factor? What has changed? Why are we so urgent this time in a way that we weren't 4 or 5 weeks ago? And I think that's it.
Do you perhaps also think that the fact that the US Vice President Joe Biden has started to rattle cages a little bit more. He started saying that we cannot be on the brink of a new conflict in Ukraine. We cannot see Ukraine going. And there is also this talk of supplying the Ukrainian authorities with arms. I mean, one gets the impression perhaps that the clock is being pushed faster, not from within Europe, but from on the other side of the Atlantic.
Yes, I feel like almost using a Bushism in this, is saying
there is
really an egregious case of misunderestimating here that's been going on. Oh, by golly, Obama has been asleep on the watch on this one. Because, of course, as we were hearing Emma all the way, he's going to do a new national security strategy, which will be his last in his thing. And we've heard before, always really, it's about the pivot to Asia. Golly, 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 the pivot to Asia for the US foreign policy, they were asleep on the case with the rise of ISIS, which was understood, and there was asleep on... quite how dangerous, as we were describing just before, Ukraine is. But what I do think is worrying, because it will upset Putin, it will provoke him, is that they go into the old toolbox. Let's rearm our POWs. Let's arm our proxies. Let's have rapid deployment exercises. I think the real thing in prospect, I'd be very interested to hear Alessio's response to this, I think one of the part of the Putin game is, yes, he's chewing out, through his allies, by hybrid warfare, an enclave. Quite a serious enclave, and it gets bigger because they can't be the Minsk agreement lines now because they've got so much more in eastern Ukraine. But the other thing that he is quite clearly aiming at is actually not only destabilizing, but making unviable as a practical modern state the rest of Ukraine, because that way they can't be armed, and that way that's a way to hold this rather menacing rhetoric, which, by the way, Moscow, of course, will take very seriously from the US and its allies through NATO. There seems to be almost in NATO a curious atmosphere which has entered this week. At last, we're back to core business. Now we know what we're really for, after all, in the Cold War, which is another Cold War.
Another Cold War, which obviously they had the deployment of British and other troops to the likes of what, Poland,
Black
Romania,
Eagle and
etc. Yep. Yesterday. So do you get the impression from what Robert was saying there that the West is actually drawing, I hate to say it, battle lines, but is drawing lines that actually Vladimir Putin may well have been expecting for some time?
In a way, but I think the problem is slightly different, in the sense that we're facing a situation where there is a clear mismatch between what public attention, general public attention in Western Europe and in developed countries in general, is in terms of what the security problems are, and the reality of international security, as it were. Because in terms of public perception, even though ever since the Wales summit and NATO last September and the commitment of the 2%, what we've seen is Western governments finding very difficult to commit themselves to that 2%. So even though formally everybody committed to it, the idea to sell it to their own people, well, because probably it's very difficult to sell it to the people, right?
And so
I think in this sense, that's part of an important mismatch, because in turn, it makes it very difficult to devise a strategy. If you have a problem that is Russia in eastern Ukraine, which is very conventional, very sort of military and kinetic in many respects, but then you have ISIL, IS, whichever way you want to call it, in the Middle East, which is connected to a different type of problem altogether. These are two very different type of threats. They require different means, not necessarily the same type of means, but they all share the same problem. They require a political commitment to invest into defence in order to address these issues. Now, this is not happening. Hence, we've seen all this swinging right, left and centre on trying through diplomatic channel to square a circle that you can't possibly square, because if everything had to come to push, you know, in one day, we can't address a military problem in eastern Ukraine while maintaining all operational commitments on all other fronts, including, but not, you know, not just IS in the Middle East.
It's something that I think a lot of defence experts have been saying for quite some time, ever since there have been whole-scale reductions in national militaries all over the world. Now, while we contemplate, or let us leave the prospect of Merkel and Hollande sitting down to a late-night dinner this evening, we shall let our imaginations run with that quietly. Let's move on to another conflict that, of course, in Syria and Iraq, the ISIS conflict, the IS conflict. It is now 3 days since the video emerged of the Jordanian pilot Muaz al-Kasasbi being burned to death by Islamic State militants. Since then, the streets of his home nation of Jordan have been filled by people protesting. At first, they were angry at what they believed was America dragging Jordan into a conflict that suddenly was costing them very dear. The streets have been full again today, however, but the mood is decidedly different. There is now nothing but support for Amman's rapid escalation of airstrikes against Islamic State targets. Alessio, why this sudden gear change in terms of support, in terms of what is happening in the streets of Jordan?
Well, you know, I think that I was actually quite surprised. If you want, let me reverse the answer to the question, in the sense that I was quite surprised that people were not expecting that this type of turn would take place, because what we're talking about, it's a shocking video showing the most brutal form of behaviour against a human being. How would you ever expect, you know, people around that are so emotionally involved into this affair, who have seen the video, not to react like, well, let's dish them back, you know, let's play a little bit of a revenge game here because they actually deserve it. I think they did a tremendous disservice to themselves, and in a way, of course, IS never really wanted to gain some sort of a high moral ground, but probably in trying to play yet again the card of creating greater support by showing their resolute attitude towards those who are striking them, and they sort of didn't really take into account the fact that this actually could backfire. Which is exactly what happened. You know, it actually started sort of reducing the broader support against this Muslim cause, as it were, of creating an Islamic State, telling us, like, actually, no, these people aren't behaving like we think someone should behave. So it's probably good that we're going after them. So these are strikes, and the fact that the Jordanian government is feeling kind of confident about sort of striking back, I think is very much consistent with the build-up of emotions around the sacrifice and the killing of the pilot.
So it is, would you say, emotionally charged here? Because up until this point, Jordan had been quite... Well, a lot of the Arab states had not actually dropped any bombs or pulled any triggers. They had been a sort of ancillary participant.
Three or four.
And yet, suddenly, as soon as one of the pilots comes down, everybody wants to plough in. Even, I think, there was talk of King Abdullah taking to the skies, former fighter pilot himself.
But no, it's not a laughing matter. It's very interesting. I think ISIS have miscalculated with this because let's see what the guts of the 22-minute thing was. It was identifying name by name six Jordanian pilots and saying where they were living. And they obviously thought, and I think this speaks to the complexion of ISIS leadership, which I'll mention in a minute, that they were going to split Jordan, and particularly the detachment of the royal house, the Hashemites, from the bulk of the Palestinian population. It doesn't matter that the king's wife is a Palestinian. In fact, it's united them, as you say.
She was on the streets today.
You know, the UAE has withdrawn from air operations, and they thought that happened in December when
Kassaspe was
shot down.
His capture.
And now. I think that there is a unity against them because there is a very tough and nasty military leadership, which we are not talking about nearly enough in ISIS, and it's a Chechen, and there are Berbers, and they do a lot of the sadistic violence because it's not their territory. It is not a rerun of al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in around 2005 and 2006. And I'm afraid, and I blame myself for this too, a lot of the analysis have been quite sloppy in this. It is something new. It's a new cocktail. Some of the elements are familiar, some aren't. But I do think there are two things that are happening. I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about it. One, Islam is talking globally against this, which is very interesting. And the other thing is that really sharp people, Major General Jonathan Shaw, former Director of Special Forces, writing in the Evening Standard, a London paper, big article today, say, yes, our political leaders have to have the resolve because actually ISIS can be defeated. It can be written down on the ground. That is a big change.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with Emma Nelson, joined by Robert Fox and Alessio Patilano. When we return, we discuss a new direction for the militant group Boko Haram.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites, we don't want to set up arguments, we just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was almost worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
The time is, 1824 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. For the first time, the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram has carried out an attack in Niger. The Islamist extremist organisation has until now mainly confined its offensive to Nigeria, but earlier this week it carried out an attack on a town in Cameroon as well. So why is Boko Haram looking to take its fight abroad? Well, still with me, Robert Fox and Alessio Patilano. Robert, let us begin with you. What has changed in Boko Haram? Haram's tactic strategy that has meant that they are leaving Nigeria and looking abroad?
I think something is becoming clearer about Boko Haram and the way and what we've it fits with what they've been doing in Nigeria. And I think it's what we now call, in postmodern terms, the Genghis Khan strategy, where you just tear up the earth. It really is scorched earth, but a scorched earth offensive. It's an existential problem. And they go on and they go on and they go on. Because they, unlike ISIS, it seems they can't even make a pretense at running an economy or a state or whatever. I think we are coming to a very interesting point, though. You're absolutely right with, first of all, the raid into Cameroon and now Niger. And now they seem to be heading for a collision with Chad, which might prove extremely interesting, because the Chadians have already stood up a force, quite a considerable force, well-trained, of 2,500, that are moving towards Boko Haram. And they will have French support and French air support. Watch this space.
I mean, earlier on this week, I think the Nigerian and Chadian jets have been bombing Boko Haram targets. But what you just said about this not being like Islamic State, when we read about the practices of the militants, this may means a sort of cajoling and then brutally treating people in towns that they take over. It has been argued that this is actually the other Islamic State that we're not really paying enough attention to, are we, Alessio?
Yes. So from what we've seen so far in terms of the way of operating and the way they're trying to create an ever-increasing broader space under their control, the idea really is to... or the impression that one has is that of an Islamic State Mark II, as it were, in a different area. What is interesting also that they're trying to look at transboundary across different states. First of all, because it's slightly more complicated to it becomes very complicated for national authorities to go after them. If you go in and out across the boundaries of different countries, it's very difficult to, especially countries in Africa, whereby sort of the competences and the coordination over the boundaries is never really particularly strong. Then it becomes part of your tactical advantage, if you want, to sort of wreck chaos around you and at the same time, out of their chaos, create a sort of an area of influence, as it were.
To what degree do you also think that what's been described as, I think, a special brand of nonchalance from the likes of Goodluck Jonathan and those in control in Nigeria have just allowed the likes of Boko Haram to wreak this chaos and everyone has just quietly accepted it?
I think it's a little bit unfair. I mean, it depends. You know, this is the classic sort of situation of the half-empty, half-full glass. It depends on where you position your perspective. I think it's a little bit unfair to say that, because I was reading earlier on today about the Nigerian army and how it is part also of the army that the Boko Haram managed actually to conduct this operation. I think to an extent that is certainly true because of the way they operate, they recruit and sort of they are present on the territory. On the other, it's very difficult to fully police and constantly police these territories because we're talking about very wide areas of space. So I have a full sort of capacity to constantly monitor what's happened in it. You know, this is not the easiest task. So in this respect, I'm only sort of half convinced that it is a failure of the local regimes. I think part of it is also just that the geography of control is very difficult.
Nonetheless, I mean, we've seen in the last year an almost systemic failure of Goodluck Jonathan's government to address big crises. The kidnapping of the 200 girls was barely mentioned for a long, long time until the West actually brought the problem to Goodluck Jonathan's doorstep. I mean, is there something that could be done or should be done by those in power or those seeking re-election in the next couple of weeks in Nigeria?
I think that we're observing the activities of a classic plutocracy here that is not really interested. Mm. It is very ethnically and confessionally divided too, which is part of the problem, the complexity, as Alessio was describing. I'm frankly not very sanguine that actually the indigenous authorities will do much. But I do think there's another very interesting thing, another very interesting absence is America, of course, in this. America is shouting from the sidelines, but very, very deep back, and saying sub-Saharan Africa is really international in terms of international security is the responsibility of France, obviously one, but and two, another notorious absentee, the Brits. Mm. But this is the only way you're going to do it. What I think you will see, and this is actually where there is something in common with IS, ISIL, is that what you're going to have to develop through surveillance of the kind that Alessio was hinting is so badly needed, big aerial, not only drones, but satellites, the whole thing. It's command and control is going to be very important in this. And you will see a thing which... a phenomenon which the phrase was coined by General Sir Rupert Smith, the man who did War Among the People, strategic raiding. It's where you will drop in commando-style raids to take out concentrations of fighters when you find them on the ground. It is possible to do it. It's high risk. We're not talking about occupation. It's in and out. Of course, it has to be local forces in the lead, but local forces with their trainers in and among them and running them. And General Martin Dempsey, the senior soldier of all in the US, has hinted at this kind of methodology too.
Let's move back briefly in the couple of minutes that remained in this half hour. Let's go back to that room. François Hollande, Angela Merkel, and later on tonight, Vladimir Putin. Hollande and Merkel contemplating this evening's task of coaxing the Russian president out of Ukraine. How much do you think they'll have in the back of their minds a theory that's emerged that Russia's president may well have Asperger's? A spokesman for President Putin has dismissed the claims as stupidity not worthy of comment. Alessio, this was a study carried out by the Pentagon in 2008. I think they were watching a couple of videos, so I don't think it stands up to a great amount of scrutiny. But it does perhaps highlight that thing that we do quite like to medicalise a baddie, don't we?
Oh yeah, no, sure. I mean, think about all the James Bond movies. The best villains usually have some medical disease that nobody ever heard of. It just makes it more rounder. It provides an explanation of why and how a human being can, you know, become so evil and twisted. There must be some medical explanation for it. I'm hoping for Merkel and Hollande tonight as they're having dinner. That's not the case, because otherwise it's going to be not a very pleasant dinner after all.
I can't imagine it being much fun to start off with, but dealing with someone with what described as a control freak, difficult in social situations, to what degree must we say, oh yeah, of course, we all thought that he was on the spectrum.
It's a cheap shot. Yeah. I think we're all a bit weird. He's a bit weird. We know this with the chest beating and the cold bath. We love to hook on a nice little label of psychobabble, don't we? I think what the great advantage of Mrs. Merkel there is that they can choose two languages. Putin, as we know, speaks very, very good German, but when he gets angry, he switches to Russian, and she can follow him.
I
think that's very, very important. It's why Rouhani and Zarif of Iran are so good, because they're absolutely fluent in English. So, they could make it absolutely clear what they mean and want.
Gentlemen, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Robert Fox and Alessio Patilano, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House, including the latest from Tunis. We meet a man who's chronicled the road less travelled in the Midwest, running from along the America's spine, one could argue. Plus, we look at the latest films out this week. So lots to look forward to in the next half hour. Before we get started on all that, let's get the latest world news headlines now. Here's Jonathan.
Thank you very much. Investigators say power was cut to both engines on the Transasia plane that crashed in Taiwan on Wednesday. The plane suffered a lack of thrust before crashing into a river in Taipei. killing 35 people. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the French President François Hollande have just arrived in Moscow this evening for talks with the Russian President Vladimir Putin on the Ukraine crisis. Their visit follows 5 hours of late-night talks with Ukrainian leader Petro Poroshenko in Kiev. The Greek finance minister said on Friday that the country had no other choice but to seek agreement with its creditors and excluded the possibility of a bailout for future talks. And the Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott has vowed to defeat a challenge to his leadership. A vote will be held in Canberra on Tuesday and follows a drop in the Prime Minister's ratings in the last 6 months. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. Jonathan will return in a little under 30 minutes to bring us a full roundup of today's news. After that, Marcus Hippie will be behind the microphone, bringing you a lovely helping of this week's episode of The Menu. In the meantime, though, welcome back to Midori House. We're live here on Monocle 24. The time in Moscow is 21:35, 18:35 here in London, in Rio, 16:35. This is Emma Nelson. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we head to Tunis. Marcus Hippie spoke to our woman in the Tunisian capital, Nevine Kotar, just a few moments ago, and they began by talking about the country finally having a government as the new prime minister secured the vote of confidence on Thursday.
Yes, I have to say it took quite a long time. If you remember, the parliamentary election was on the 23rd of October last year, and it took them over 100 days. I mean, in other countries, that's when, you know, the first sort of review of the government's performance is published, to form this government. And what has happened is that Nida Tunis, the party with the largest number of seats in parliament, was forced, more or less because of the math and the number of seats they needed, to go into coalition with a party their party supporters and members really hate. They had to go into coalition with the political Islamists. So this vote took wasn't actually that easy. There were 136 interventions on Wednesday and Thursday before the MPs voted for it. There was a lot of opposition to this coalition, and I think we have to see how stable this new government will actually be.
Could you tell us about the implications of Tunisia not having a government?
Well, it just meant that there are no policies being addressed, there are no reforms being started, nobody actually really felt responsible for anything. And that has not just been the case since October, it has been the case for quite a long time, because the previous government that was in place was only meant to be in place for a year until the constitution was finished. That took longer, but it meant that none of the government ministries were actually felt that they had a democratic mandate to do anything. And I think that's been quite frustrating for the Tunisian public, and it's something that now hopefully will start again, that ministers will actually take responsibility for their portfolios and start looking into the problems that this country has.
Well, in other news, the country is now facing the prospects of being banned from the next Africa Cup in 2017. Navina, what's going on there?
Yes, it was quite an extraordinary match on Saturday. I think I was able to watch it with Tunisians who were actually very hopeful they would make it to the quarter final. And in the 90th minute, the referee basically gave a penalty to Equatorial Guinea. Equatorial Guinea then secured a goal. And then from then on, it just went downhill for Tunisia. The Tunisians are accusing this judge of being biased, and they are also accusing the host, Equatorial Guinea, of having paid this judge. So, and afterwards, there was a bit of a the Tunisian team didn't behave properly, I have to say. After the match, they got quite aggressive. So they have been fined. They're refusing to apologize. The team is refusing to apologize. And if they don't apologize, they will be banned from the next Africa Cup of Nations.
What is the public opinion? Do you think there is going to be an apology?
Well, I have to say, I think the public opinion is behind the football team. Even the president has sort of said that they feel that the body that is meant to look after this didn't really, was basically biased, and that they feel that this referee has been paid. And another implication of this match was that there have actually been quite a few racist attacks on sub-Saharan Africans here after the match, who very frustrated Tunisian supporters felt, you know, we're supporting the wrong team. So it's actually turned quite sour, this whole thing here.
And finally, Navina, before we let you go, let's head to Algeria. There have been ongoing protests about whether the government should push ahead and start exploiting shale gas.
Yes, it's quite a big issue in Algeria, and it's going a bit underreported because the difficulty of getting into the country. The government is struggling with the falling oil price. 95% of Algerian revenues depend on oil. So they are thinking we should exploit the gas we have, and that's shale gas. But that's far south in actually quite a dry, hot area of Algeria. And the local residents who live there are really concerned that if they start exploiting shale gas, which requires a lot of water, that could dry up their agricultural production and it would have an impact on the water supply there. So there have been quite regular protests actually that are quite big in southern Algeria, and now the government has promised to review the need to do this and it has promised to defer it. But these protests keep on happening, not just in the south but also sometimes in the capital.
And that was Navina Kotor talking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we fasten our seatbelts and slide down the spine of the United States.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Midori House. This is Emma Nelson. Now, the title and indeed the cover of my next guest's book is, I suspect, not intended to thrill deeply. The image on the front of Slow Road to Brownsville is decidedly, well, brown. Inside, however, is the account of the author's journey along Highway 83, which, if you were to picture the map of the United States, runs slap down the centre, as if the country perhaps had been neatly severed in two with a cheese wire. But does the quietness of the title belie a side to the US, which many of us perhaps choose not to see? Well, David Reynolds, the author, joins me in the studio now. A very warm welcome to the programme, David. Let us begin a little with the motivation, why you wrote this book. There is a family connection here, isn't there? Explain it to us.
There is. My grandfather disappeared almost 100 years ago to a tiny town in northern Canada called Swan River. And I went there 10, 15 years ago to find out about him. And then I started going back for fun. And one time I was there and I was driving along with an elderly man in my car. And he just pointed to a road out of the side and said, that road goes to Brownsville. No, he didn't. He said, that road goes to Mexico. And that just amazed me because we were 2,500 miles north of the border with Mexico. But it does. This road begins in this tiny town, goes all that way through the States, just one two-lane highway.
And that was it? That was a commitment of 2,500 miles straight down south?
Yeah. And I began to think about it and thought, well, it'd be really interesting to go down there. Then I spoke to the publisher of the book about my grandfather, and he said, I'd love you to do that. And then I had to think about it a lot, but it did amount to a book in the end.
Yeah. And a very lovely one too, if I may compliment you. The book, the highway itself, we're talking about Highway 83, which is it's slap bang down the middle of the United States, takes in all manner of bits of the US that I think we all know about historically. There's an awful lot about, you know, it has its origins in Native America, but there's also hugely historical events that have taken place along this route. But it's not necessarily a road which has been chronicled very extensively.
No.
Why not?
No, it hasn't. I think, Route 66 has grabbed a lot of attention, and that's from the same era. The 100 routes or highways were built at the same time. In the late 1920s, when the government realised they needed national roads, 50 were built north-south, 50 east-west. 83 was just one of those then, and just a two-lane highway. Most of those are now gone because of the interstates, which are like our motorways. If you wanted to go from Swan River to Brownsville quickly, you wouldn't go on Highway 83, even though it's a direct route, because you could veer off onto interstates and drive much faster. So it So it means there are no trucks and things like that. It's like, say, an old A road in England, say the A30, when you know hardly anyone drives down there. But it goes through towns, and 83 becomes Main Street of a town, and then it becomes 83 again. It goes on and on and on. And it's fun, great. I mean, miles nicer than driving on a motorway or an interstate.
The places that you go through, I mean, obviously we'll sort of chart your journey as we go along through this interview, but you as we mentioned before, it has its origins in Native America. And one of the things that you established very, very early on is that you're interested in seeing how the relationship with the Native Americans and the rest of those residents along the route often were transformed or switched between an attitude of hostility and friendliness. But you said more often than not, it was friendliness which turned nasty. Tell us a little bit more about that and what you discovered as you drove along Highway 83.
Well, you mean originally friendliness turned nasty back in the 1800s because they were in the way, the Indians, of what the Americans saw as their expansion west, building railroads and roads, I guess, eventually. They were in the way. So they found various ways to get them out of the way, partly just killing them. Scorched earth policies. A lot of them died by catching diseases, and that wasn't deliberate, that had come from Europe, particularly smallpox. And then the remainder were sort of forced into doing deals, and all those deals were broken, those kind of treaties and things, absolutely every one. And they ended up with smaller and smaller reservations. And the mighty Sitting Bull, the Sioux, famous Sioux chief, was kind of got around. He was most obstructive of the lot. And he was there at the famous Custer's Last Stand. You know, they won that great battle. But after that, they lost everything.
Looking at the rest of the way that you chart your journey, one thing that I noticed as I made my way through the book and I made my way along Highway 83 with you is that an awful lot of your scenes are set in restaurants. It struck me that you ate quite a lot and you ate quite diverse food and you found yourself in the most astonishing places, a Chinese cafe and a place that sold a Long Island muff dive, which fascinated me for all the wrong reasons.
That is actually, I mean, I couldn't work that out. I heard people talking about it and it sounds kind of quite rude.
I think it does, yes.
But do you know what it is?
I was hoping that you might be able to enlighten us, given as you found it on a menu.
No, I Googled it. No, it was. I'm not sure it's something to eat, actually.
I shudder to think what was on the menu there. But I mean, did you find that the characters that you met changed, or you got a lot of what you needed for your book from meeting people in eating places, pit stops along the way?
Eating places and bars, yeah. And libraries, all sorts of places. Yeah, pit stops, you could call them. And they're always very friendly.
They are very friendly, but there are also very nasty, dark bits in this book. You're going into Republican heartlands. You're going into areas where racism is absolutely out in the open.
Yes, on a few occasions. I mean, I also met a lot of liberal people. I mean, you're probably maybe thinking of, two or three incidents. One in particular, a horrible one, where I've been talking to a man for 20 minutes, very friendly man who ran a kind of junk shop. Who was got so friendly he started giving me odd bits of stuff, like some buffalo hair that he sold for 50 cents. And then he handed me a postcard, a free old postcard, and said, oh, that's our local swimming pool, which is a famous swimming pool. It's a typical American thing. It's the largest outdoor concrete swimming pool in the world. And he wanted me to have this postcard. And then he said, you wouldn't want to go there because of the what he called immigrants that swam there.
Well,
and
did
he
you get
got
any
more graphic than that.
Did actually. You get any sense of hope from any of these people that you met?
Oh, yeah. No, I met some great liberal-type people. A wonderful woman who owns a ranch in Texas, who was one of five people in her town of 2,000, who'd voted for Obama. And those five people had to keep it a secret and had a little party when Obama won without telling anyone else. And she was fantastic. You know, on the side of the black people, they're all on the side of the Indians, actually. No one's against them.
David Reynolds, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Your book, Slow Road to Brownsville, is out now. On the back, you have a discography, which I'm assuming are the tunes that you played as you drove along. There is a reference at one point to Mozart Piano Concerto. You also have Artie Shaw, Jim Hall, Bill Evans, and this by Bruce Springsteen. This is Born to Run. We'll have to leave that saxophone alone, I'm afraid. That was Bruce Springsteen and Born to Run. 1850 here in London. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily arts review. Today we talk films with Monocle's regular film expert, Karen Krizanovich. A very warm welcome to the programme, Karen. Lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you too.
Before we launch into the best of this week, I'm just looking at a copy of the British Guardian that happens to be on my left-hand side. Front page is How Cinema Has Lost Its Edge. What's the Guardian saying by here?
No, that's all right. Has cinema lost its edge? They like to say this every once in a while, particularly when we have something like Jupiter Ascending, which is, you know, it's a little bit mean, really. But, you know, what kind of edge do they want? I think there are so many films are coming out now. There's so many people making films. World cinema is huge. And there's just a lot to look at. So saying it's losing its edge is, you know, trying to make some kind of point.
Battle of the Bland, I think.
Well,
look, we have four films to plough through. Still Life, The Interview, SpongeBob. Really?
We're just going to mention SpongeBob in passing, yeah.
All right, fine. Yeah. The little yellow guy is lurking in the corner, ready to leap out at us. But you mentioned just there Jupiter Ascending.
Yes,
Tell us a bit about this.
Right, well, we know that Lana and Andy Wachowski were famous for the Matrix trilogy.
Yes.
Which made an enormous impact on special effects particularly, but also storytelling in general. They went on after that, which is groundbreaking. I mean, it's been some years now, groundbreaking. But they went to do Cloud Atlas next, which was interesting. It was innovative. It was texturally, it was, you know, very much like the book. And now they've gone on. This is supposed to be an original, possible franchise starter for them. This is a $175 million budget of a film that is basically, they're calling a cross between The Matrix and Star Wars. It's a bloated, glossy, meandering, peculiar movie about starring Mila Kunis, who is a Russian-born toilet cleaner, basically, who has the same DNA structure as the Queen of the Universe, who has passed away. But she is a dog, literally, because he's a dog hybrid mercenary Channing Tatum with long ears and kind of a pointy beard.
Of course it is. That sounds all perfectly clear. Let's have a listen to what this film sounds like.
I know because of who and what you are, you're unable to say this. So I'll say it for you. You lied in the Commonwealth because you're a hunter who's been searching for one thing his whole life. You survived so long without it. The fact that you may have found it terrifies you, but not as much as the fact that she's down there, buried in several tons of hurricane. And if you want to see her again, and you take my advice, you get down there and you start digging.
Right, we're not lacking in scope, but it appears that this new dystopia seems to be voiced by a man from Yorkshire.
Or Sheffield, it's Sean Bean. He is another mercenary there, and they team up. It is a beautiful, special effects are fantastic, but the story is hard to follow. And also, a lot of it looks pretty naff because there's a lot of sort of faux skating through the air. Anyway.
So we're watching... I can kind of understand that you have a universe that's being built of the quality of, let's say, The Matrix, but the narrative is slightly lacking.
It is, okay. Yes. But it doesn't really deserve the drubbing it's probably going to get. It had a $175 million budget, and it's tracking at $2 million $20 million for this box office, which is really bad.
We must briefly mention prosthetic ears as well.
Prosthetic ears, yes. Looks like a little elf.
Splendid.
Or a big elf, actually.
Okay. Well, that is Jupiter Ascending. Let us now move to a completely different film, Still Life. Tell us about that.
Still Life is quite beautiful. This is Umberto Pasolini's. He's famous for doing the Full Monty. This is a really compelling drama about an unusual subject. And in fact, it's a lot alike the documentary Dreams of a Life. It's about when you find someone. He's a council worker. His name is John May. He finds people who have died alone, and then he tracks down their relatives. And he sees, as he himself is a very shy man, and he sees the same future coming for himself. So it's a love story, which is very nice. It's very sad, it's poignant, but it's beautiful as well and has some wonderful insights into solitude.
Let's hear what they have to say here.
My dad was Jumbo. Both paras. It's in the Falklands. They were best mates. He got in touch with me about 10 years ago. Wanting to find Dad, I couldn't help him, but he sent me that anyway. No, take it. I don't need it. I mean, I don't know why I kept it, really. Fine, honestly, really. It's just the shock.
I must ask, your mother, is she?
She's dead. I'm an orphan as of today.
That's not nice. Whenever it happens.
It sounds like a terribly lonely film. Is this something that you need to be in a certain frame of mind of to watch?
It wouldn't hurt. No, but it is lovely, and it's unusual to see Eddie Marsden, who usually plays a supporting character, in a romantic lead. And it's nice to see a shy, retiring council worker in a romantic lead. And that was Joan Froggatt, from best known for Downton Abbey.
It sounds incredibly British. Will it travel?
Yes, I think the Americans will like it quite a bit. And don't forget that Pasolini, well, he's not related to Pierce Paul Pasolini, but is actually related to Visconti. So there's a little film trivia for you.
Let's move on, have an abrupt and violent gear change. There's a film that made an enormous amount of headlines at the end of last year, not because of its content, well, because of its subject matter, but the political repercussions that ensued. The Interview, it nearly didn't get a release, and now it did. Is this hype about Kim Jong-un really worth it?
It's... Okay, if you liked Pineapple Express, you'll like this. It's very silly, very stupid, incredibly good looking. I was surprised at the production values of this comedy. Basically, James Franco and Seth Rogen, who also co-directed and co-wrote this, are two television professionals famous for creepy, exploitative talk shows. They go to North Korea to interview Kim Jong-un for basically just to get more... a better audience. They are then co-opted by the CIA to assassinate him. And Russell Park, as Kim, turns out to be a fan of their show, so they're compromised. It's going to be a poisoned handshake that they're going to kill him with. But Russell Park, who's starring in a new television show in America, is excellent. He's so good. Now, this film cost $44 million. It's made $7 million at the box office in America so far, but it's earned, I think, about $30 million online, which is very interesting.
And very briefly, we have about 30 seconds to explore SpongeBob Out of Water. If you're not under five and you're not a fan of gratuitous merchandising, is this film for you?
We're all excited about it. We really are, because we think it's going to do very, very well and be the weekend winner when it comes out. It may not do as well as American Sniper, which has made $255 million out of a $44 million budget. But all the film critics, this is one of the things about being a film critic. We talk about stuff and everybody's talking about SpongeBob.
Okay, so we have Still Life, The Interview, Jupiter Ascending, or SpongeBob. Which one would you go and see?
Well, SpongeBob isn't out this weekend, but this weekend I would say go see The Interview because everybody's talking about it.
Karen Grzenovic, thank you very much indeed for your time. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to Robert Fox and Alessio Patolano. My thanks too to our producer Marcus Hippie, Max Kosic and Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Stefano Fumagalli, and our studio manager Chris Chilvers. Up next after the news is The Menu. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.